Resolution.
Good, good. Well done. Sure, get a shake. Get a test. Even a brief encounter with Torah living makes it obvious that the Torah has rules for everything. Everything. There is a complete code of civil law and criminal law, organization of the state, its institutions, and there are laws governing major life milestones, birth, maturity, marriage, death. And there are what are called in English religious prescriptions, holidays, prayer, charity, moral rules. There is a specified diet, positive and negative, a dress code, code for speech, and if you look into it deeply enough, there are even rules for how and what to think and how and what to feel. Everything comes under the scope of the rules. Now, why is that? Obsessive compulsive, maybe? Yeah. Where is there room for spontaneity? Just letting yourself go. Sometimes people do something and you ask them, why did you do it? They said, I just felt like it. I didn't have any plan, no specific reason. It wasn't focused on any end. I just felt like it, so I did it. Does that have no place in Jewish life? And if it has no place in Jewish life, is that healthy? Is that reasonable? Is that normal? How are we to look at the universal application of the rules to every aspect of life and, in some sense or other, every moment of life? And to answer this question, I want to describe to you a spectrum of spontaneity to rule-boundness. More rules or less rules? I want to describe a spectrum, less to more, more or less. And then I want to point out that in a certain sense there's a cutoff point. And everything to one side of the cutoff point has one crucial characteristic, and everything the other side of the cutoff point has an opposite characteristic, and that's what explains the Torah's position on these matters. But let's start with the spectrum. And let's start with what could be called a maximally rule-bound context, where the rules are really at the maximum. Let's take a private in the army, a new inductee in training. What are the rules determined for him? Well, when he gets up in the morning and the uniform he has to wear, and the haircut that he has to have, and his posture, and his speech, yes sir, no sir, right away sir, and how he makes his bed, to the egg of a cornice at the bottom, sheet folded over on the top, and how he polishes his shoes. In some marching formations, there's an order. Eyes left, and the eyeballs have to go left. His day is pretty much planned out. Doesn't seem to be much room there for, I did it just because the spirit moved me. Oh, you did, huh? End up in the break. Let's take a musician in an orchestra. A violinist. What does he do? Well, first of all, there are the notes on the page of music. He's got to play the notes. And then the conductor will tell him how fast to play, and how slow to play, and what dynamics to put in, a little guitar here, an accelerando there, and the general interpretation of music. And then when the conductor gets finished, the concertmaster, that's the fancy name for the first violinist, will tell him for each note, whether it's played on an up bow or whether it's played on a down bow, which string to play each note on, because many notes can be played on more than one string, how much vibrato to put on each note, how much spontaneity is there in playing a violin in an orchestra? Very little, if any. It's all planned out, you just have to execute. Let's take a tackle on a football team. The defensive team. The defensive quarterback calls the defensive play, and that determines where he is and what he must do, and he's been trained how to do it, and the uniform is the uniform that the team issued him, and he'd like to wear a black helmet instead of a green helmet. Too bad. In this team, it's green helmets, you know. Black helmet? Go out and play sandlot fast in baseball or football. You're not going to play over here. How much spontaneity does he have in playing the football team? Next done. Now, here are three contexts in which what the person is doing is very rule-bound. Very rule-determined. Rather than rule-governed. Still, I don't think we feel about any of them that it's sick. Okay, I don't know what your views on are, but you put the musician in. It's not sick, it's not obsessive compulsive, it's not somehow terribly negative, it's not so somehow destructive and weird and cult-like. You seem to be quite satisfied with those activities, even though they are very rule-bound. Okay, now let's move out on the spectrum a little bit. Let's talk about the Army lieutenant. That's no matter. He has men under him. I don't know how many men the lieutenant has, 1,000 men, or 500 men, or whatever it is. And he disposes them in battle. Now, of course, he's given orders. Take that hill. But how should he take the hill? A massive charge down the center? Or sending scouts around the back and having a decoy action, or calling in airstrikes, or, you know, how should he do it? It's more or less left up to him. Except that he has to respect the resources that are available. And he has to do his best to achieve the goal, which is to take the hill with the minimum number of losses and the maximum effect against the enemy. If he shows poor judgment, if he tries the mass assault in the front and loses half his men, he's not going to be a lieutenant for long. They trained him to do it in such a way as to minimize losses, not maximize losses. If he can't figure out a better way than that, he's not going to be there. Let's take the football quarterback. The football quarterback also has some freedom. He can call the plays. Of course, there are limits. He can't call a play which requires a 30-yard lateral pass if it's over the boundary line of the field, because then the ball's out of bounds and they lose the play. And he can't call a stupid play. He's not going to kick on the first down because he's got 4 downs to make 10 yards. Why should he kick on the first down?
He does that, he's going to be out.
For the non-Americans, you just have to learn a real game called football. You know, to the other games, you know, to put them in the second league.
So, he has some freedom of operation, freedom of judgment, but it's considerably limited. Same is true with the conductor of the orchestra. There are the notes on the page. They have to be played. He can fiddle a little bit. For example, in the final, if the final chord of a piece is a major chord, it is accepted practice to tell those who are playing the third of the chord to play it a little sharp, a little off the true pitch, because that makes the chord sound bright, crisp, and strong. And that's the way to end the piece, bright, crisp, and strong. So there's a kind of tradition of playing it a little bit up, a little bit higher than the true pitch of the note. And he has some freedom with respect to the tempo, but there are limits. If it's a Mozart minuet, he can't play it like a Beethoven scherzo. You know, he can't play it 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and race you through it. That's not a minuet. Minuet is 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Now, I describe this category as a category in which you have rules of operation, rules of validity, with a fixed goal. The rules don't dictate everything you do. The rules dictate boundary conditions. If you step over this rule, you're going to lose everything. And within the rules, you can choose, but you have to be guided by the goal. And if you make a choice, someone will ask you, why did you choose that? And you probably better have a good answer. If the conductor cannot explain why he put the rubato on this note, then he's not going to be a conductor for long. The quarterback can't explain why he tried a handoff rather than a pass. He's not going to be a quarterback for long. He can call it, but he better justify it afterwards. So that's a little further out on the spectrum of having freedom to choose between alternatives. Another step out is the free Sunday afternoon. It's Sunday afternoon. What shall I do? My business obligations are up to date. My health is good. Nobody in my family has any special needs. What shall I do? Gosh, it's an awful lot. I can go mountain climbing, I can play doubles tennis, I can catch up on my reading, I can go to the museum, I can putter around in the garden in the backyard, I can listen to music, or do some of them simultaneously, visit some friends and chat, go out to eat. I have really a lot of choices. Of course, there's still some boundary conditions. One thing I am not going to do is steal your Ferrari and go driving around the countryside, because I don't steal. I just don't do that. So there still are some limits. This I would call a free choice within minimal boundaries, minimal limits. The rules set these minimal limits. Well, within those minimal limits, choice is really very free. Maybe there is even more freedom and more spontaneity, but this will do the job that I want. Now, it seems to me that if you are within the first two scenarios, then a certain very important principle that I'm about to describe to you applies. And if you're in the third scenario, that principle no longer applies. And that explains the difference between the scenarios and their significance. And the difference is this. When there are values that are relevant to the decision, then typically you find yourself in situations one or two. What makes the free Sunday afternoon really free is that no significant values apply. The minute you apply values to the situation, the decision is no longer free. And your options are drastically cut down. Sometimes cut down to one, sometimes cut down to zero, because nothing does a perfect job.
Watch how this works. Sunday afternoon, what shall I do? I have all those alternatives. But now, actually, I could do some exercise. I've just been too sedentary, and for my circulation and my muscular strength and my coordination and balance, and not to mention releasing tension. So exercise would be good for me. If so, going to the museum and puttering around in the garden and catching up on my reading and visiting friends are no longer options, because that's not going to help my physical health. Now let's suppose another value that applies is increasing my interpersonal sensitivity. We have to work on treating people with sensitivity. Well, then solo mountain climbing is out, because that's not going to help. At this point, maybe only the doubles tennis is available. All of a sudden, that tremendous range of alternatives drops down to one. See, the goal there is, when I crush the other team to doubles tennis, not to lord it over them and not to make fun of them, but to treat them with kindness and no condescension, and encouragement. Next time, maybe you'll lose by 2 less points. Something like that. What makes the free Sunday afternoon really free, what gives you such a wide set of options, is the fact that no significant values apply. The minute you call into play your values, they drastically reduce the options available, and if you're a normal person with a reasonable set of values, it's going to become very narrowly reduced, if not focused on one as clearly the best, and the others are going to be clearly secondary. Especially if you take into account, as you should, values that are focused internally as well as externally. Here, I think that popular discussion and even philosophical discussion overlooks a very important aspect of values. Every action that you perform has a double effect. It has an effect on the world around you, and it has an effect on you. If you choose to do something and you're successful in doing it, that will reinforce whatever the motivation was that led you to do it. Now, if you choose to play doubles tennis and you choose to win, and you win, and that's motivated by aggressiveness and competitiveness, you're going to reinforce your aggressiveness and competitiveness. So a person who has a care for developing his character in a certain way asks about each action, not only what will it do to the world around me, but he asks, what will it do to me? So, for example, there was a man who came to the Chafetz Chaim and said, I've been offered a job in a bank. Should I take it or not? So the Chafetz Chaim said, if you are the bank teller who receives deposits, don't take the job. If you are the bank teller that pays out withdrawals, take the job. Why? Because if you receive deposits, you're going to be taking in money all day. Okay, it's not your money. Still, people are giving you money and you're taking it. Whereas if you're paying out withdrawals, the opposite is the case. And over years of constant repetition, taking in money is not going to be good for you. Where did the Chafetz Chaim learn this? He learned it from a Rambam. The Rambam writes in the Laws of Charity, if you have a certain amount of money to give, and you could give it all in one lump sum to a needy person, a genuinely needy person, or you could divide it up into smaller sums and give it out on repeated occasions, do the latter. Because every time you put your hand in your pocket to give money to somebody, it reinforces the habit of giving money and being sensitive. If you have a lump sum for the month and you give it once, then 100 times that month when somebody asks you, you're going to say no. And that's going to reinforce saying no. It'll become easier and easier to say no. You will be motivated to share the pain that the person is asking. Whereas if you give each time, you're motivated to respond to the pain and empathize and provide. So one has to have a two-dimensional appraisal
What is it going to do for the world, and what is it going to do for me? I'll tell you a particularly subtle story about this, which somebody came to a Rebbe and he said, my life was in danger and I almost died, and then I was saved, and I made a vow to give 400 rubles to charity, and put down the desk, here it is, please give to charity. Went out. 5 minutes later, a man came in and said, Rebbe, I have to marry off my daughter and I need 400 rubles. So the Rebbe said, this guy gives me 400. 5 minutes later, somebody else comes in and asks for exactly 400. Could it be clearer than that? He said, yeah, take the 400. A minute goes by, he says to his guy, run, get the guy back. Catch him and get him back. Brings it back in. The Rebbe says, put the 400 rubles on the desk. He does so, and he says, wait for me. Go outside and wait. Waits. An hour later, the Rebbe calls him in and says, okay, take the 400 rubles, they're yours, marry off your daughter. Right? So the Gabbai, who is a privileged character, says to the Rebbe, let's be careful. You know, come on. You don't play games. Get it to him, call him back, and give it to him again. So he says, I gave him the money, and as he walked out, I thought to myself, I'm giving one man $400. 400 rubles. Maybe it would be better to divide it up. If it's 20 taxes, it's 20. Maybe you learned something about the marginal utility of life. I don't know. Kind of stuck about. And then he said, I realized that one of these thoughts, the first thought to give the 400, or the second thought to divide it up in 20 taxes of 20, one of them came from the Yetzer Tov, and one came from the Yetzer Hara. One came for the good inclination, and one came for the evil inclination. And I had to figure out which is which. Now notice, both thoughts are to give the money away. The thought wasn't to invest the money in AT&T. Both were to give it away. Still, he said, one must have come from the good side and one came from the bad side. You had to figure out which is which. He said, it took me an hour to figure out which is which. So the Gabbai, being Jewish, said, "Who? How'd you figure it out? How did you figure out that the first thought was right, the second thought was wrong?" He said, because the second thought presented itself to me as problems. Don't give all the money to one person. Give it out in 20 packages. He said, I realized that any thought that starts with don't give is the wrong thought. It was don't, and then yes, give to somebody else. Because it's coming from a place in me that says don't give. And I don't want to reinforce that. I want to reinforce give, not don't give. So the inner responsibility and the inner dimension of building your character, if that is one of your values, and it ought to be one of your values, because building character is a way of influencing your long-term decisions, the long-term of your actions. When you build character, you improve your actions over the long term. If you put that in the perspective as a value, then your actions are all going to be graded. Nothing's going to be free. But when you ask about each action, what does it reinforce in me, and what does it dampen, what does it lead to extinction in me, it will be better or worse on those grounds. And you're not going to have that free Sunday afternoon syndrome where there are 100 things you could do and it's just a free choice. You with me so far? Yeah.
Isn't the story of the Rebbe the Eric Babson and the Rami Chavos Chaim? Rami Chavos Chaim is saying to give it to a lot of people. Right? Don't give it to one person, give it to a lot of people. And the story of the Rebbe saying it.
No, they're not the same at all. You're looking at the external effect. Yeah, sorry. You're looking at the effect of the action per se. He's looking at the psychological origin of the decision. If I don't look at the origin of the decision, and I ask, I have my money, how shall I give it out? Give it out this way, give it out that way. But here he had given it to somebody who's going to take it back and give it to somebody else. And the action of taking it back starts with, don't give it to him. Rather, in the Rambam's cases, don't give it. I have the money. What shall I do with it? Answer, give it out in small packages. There's no don't give. Now, so if you are And scenario three, free Sunday afternoon, is because no significant values apply to the decision, and that's why you have this freedom to, among myriads of alternatives, all of which are equally open to you. Now, the explanation for the Jewish position is very simple. At no time in life are you free of values that apply to your decision. There is no such thing. Every moment, every situation, every resource, values apply. There's no time where your choice is really trivial and dead. It makes no difference what you do. Because, in terms of the last consideration, building your character is a constant responsibility, a constant preoccupation, and you always have to be asking, if I do this, what's going to make me? What will happen to me? And then, sensitivity to the impact of your actions. Also, if you are sensitive to the effects of your actions, then there are usually better or worse ways to do whatever it is you're doing. How shall I come to yeshiva in the afternoon? Shall I walk? Shall I ride a bicycle? Shall I ride the bus? Shall I come to a taxi cab? One would be the exercise. One costs more and leaves me less money for my family. Obviously, there are values that apply here. And one makes the best of the alternatives that are available. So it is with every decision. And that's why the Torah does not tolerate the free Sunday afternoon. Because you never are in a free Sunday afternoon. That's the underlying principle. That's the first point I want to get across. Everybody's with me so far? Now, I want to describe to you instances of scenario two. I'm not sure that people really appreciate how much of Torah living is scenario two. There are a lot of rules, and we normally think of the rules as really straightforwardly dictatorial and quite detailed. Nevertheless, there is a considerable application of scenario two, where the rules set up the boundary conditions, and the goal is clear, but the means really are left up to the individual to decide, or decide together with his advisors, how best to fulfill it. Let's take prayer. Prayer is really a mixture of one and two, and I want to speak to both points. As you all know, the text of the prayer, the minimal text of the prayer, is fixed. You have to say all those words. But, I assume most or all of you know, you can add. Some have the custom of adding words, and you can add in English, or Italian, or Esperanto, whatever you feel more comfortable with. And those who say that you shouldn't add a word, but you can certainly add in Kavanah, stop and think the extra thoughts that you want to think. There are specified places where you can add these things into the prayer. So on the one hand, there is a minimum that is dictated, but on the other hand, it's open for a person to add extras, and it's open for a person to address God at any time, in any circumstances, in his own language, outside of the formal context of prayer. Just that the three daily prayers and extra prayers on Shabbos and holidays, they must be prayed. Now, many people are disturbed that in prayer you have any of scenario one at all. There's a text that's dictated for me to pray? Prayer surely is an affair of the heart. Chazal defined prayer as avodah shebalev, service of the heart. How can you dictate to me words that I'm supposed to say heartfelt? Maybe my heart doesn't agree. Maybe my heart isn't in those words. So wouldn't it be the grossest hypocrisy for me to say the words, thinking all the while I don't really mean them, when the real performance is service of the heart? Now, the answer, I believe, is yes. If you say them and you think, I don't agree with this, I don't mean this, I can't identify with this, there's something wrong there, something seriously wrong there. I'm not passing Shabbos now, this is for the tapes. I'm not saying you shouldn't say it, but I'm saying there's something seriously wrong. But there's a way around it. And the way around it is this. Here's an analogy that I had given to some of you in a different context. It fits here as well. You go to your doctor, and he does a general checkup, and then he says to you, I see that you are developing a certain condition. It's not life-threatening, but you should take care of it. Here's a prescription. Go to the pharmacist, get this medicine, take one pill a month, and it'll go away. There's a standard condition, we know about it. So you go to the pharmacist, he hands the prescription. The pharmacist says, oh, yes, we have this stuff. I'll be glad to get it to you. You mind if I ask you a personal question? And you say, well, ask and I'll see if I'll decide to answer or not. So he says, I see you have a prescription for this medicine. Do you really want this medicine? Are you honestly and sincerely requesting this medicine? Now what should I say? I don't know what the condition is. He rattled off a 15-syllable Latin term, you know, gobbly, 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 goat. And this stuff is Rumpelstiltskin. I don't know what it is. You know, to me it could be fresh chalk. It's just these white pills. Do I really want this stuff? I don't know what's going on here. I don't know the biochemistry. I don't know the physiology, pharmacology. So I really don't know what I'm doing. But am I, on the other hand, insincere, dishonest, hypocritical? I don't think so. I'm relying on my doctor. I might be stupid, but it's not insincere and dishonest and hypocritical. I'm relying on the fact that he was trained, he's certified, he has years of experience, and he's in it to maintain his reputation, and therefore, I should be able to trust him. Now, suppose a person says, and I know that this happens to many people, the prayer asks me to petition God to restore the temple and the animal sacrifices. That's tough. That's very tough. Do I really want to see animal sacrifices? Okay, I'm not ready to give up hamburgers. You know, I really do enjoy hamburgers and steak and chicken and things like that. But, you know, that's for my diet. So I want to see this as a religious performance. It's very hard for me to get up enthusiasm for slaughtering animals and pouring out their blood on the altar. So how could I ask for this? And the answer is that these prayers were composed 2,500 years ago by the men of the Great Assembly, who included the last prophets. These are the people who were closest to God, understood God, God's revelation, God's Torah, better than anybody else since. And they said these things are necessary for a full expression of Jewish spirituality. Now, maybe I don't understand them. There's certain elements here that I really don't understand. So what? Why can't I rely on their judgment? I say to God as follows. I come to the blessing that says, restore the temple. And I say, listen, God, if you asked me, on the basis of my intuition, I wouldn't be here. I certainly wouldn't be saying this. But they told me it's important, and I trust them. I trust them that they know, they knew more than I know, understood more than I understand. They have greater sensitivity than I. And therefore, I'm asking for it in their name. Just like I say to the pharmacist, I'm asking for the medicine in my doctor's name. And then I don't think it's insincere. I don't think it's dishonest or hypocritical. I sincerely want it. I want it because I'm relying on their authority. So that is the way in which you can say those words without your own personal understanding and yet identify with it and not be misrepresenting yourself. You with it? Now, in addition to that, the individual is encouraged to express himself in other areas which aren't explicitly in the prayer and to say out what's in his heart, say out what's in his mind, his hopes, his fears, his ecstasy of successes and his devastation and defeat, so that the relationship with God will encompass all of them and all of what's unique about him. And there, indeed, it is going to vary from person to person. Of course, there's a goal. The goal is to build an honest, trusting relationship with God.
and that will require some selectivity. Not everything should be said. Not anything can be said in just any old way. But there is room for breadth of decision. And therefore, in that case, section of prayer, that area of prayer, you have that extra area of choice, and that's why it's really a living scenario too. Everybody with me so far? Okay, another example. There's a verse in the Torah, Kedoshim Tihyu, you shall be holy. Now, what does that mean? One might think there are 613 commandments. Surely it is the commandments that make us holy. Proof? What's the proof that the commandments make us holy? You say it at least 30 times a day. I share to the Shanu b'mitzvosav v'tzivonu, who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us. Every time we make such a blessing, you're saying God sanctified us with the commandments. So maybe be holy is a kind of summary of the effect of the 613 commandments. Maybe it's nothing new. It's a kind of explanation of the impact of the commandments. Says the Ramban, no. No, that's not what it means. What it means is this. The commandments, the literal, explicit commandments, set a minimum. Everybody has to live up to that minimum. Above and beyond that, set yourself to infuse your life with holiness more than the minimum that the explicit commandments require. Tell that to the Christians who think that the law is inhuman and impossible to fulfill. That for us, the law is not enough. You have to go beyond and add extra. That's in your personal life. The Ramban cross-references a verse from Deuteronomy, you shall do what is straight and good in God's eyes. And there he says the same thing about interpersonal relations. The Torah does not give complete rules for how to relate to other people. It gives a minimum set of instructions that everyone has to live up to. And above and beyond that, seek to do what is straight and good in God's eyes in relating to other people. Now, both of these require a person to grow beyond the minimum of the explicit rules. But here, different people are going to grow in different ways. Based on each person's strength, different people are going to grow in different ways. Helping other people, for some people, it's very difficult to let go of money. And they have a lot of it. So, the difficulty may be to learn to give to other people. When we were living in Boston 100 years ago, there was a quite wealthy gentleman, and he was very hospitable to the religious community, especially for religious students. One Friday night, there was a meeting of religious students in his house, and it was pouring cats and dogs. Of course, there was no air there, and even if there was an air, you can't carry an umbrella. Everybody walked in soaked to the gills. This gentleman, who had live-in servants in his house, in his mansion, stood by the front door for 2 hours. Each student that came in, the boys, maybe it was just the boys, meeting, I don't remember. But he took the boys up to his bedroom and gave them a suit. He had enough suits. He actually owned the knitting mills. And each person got a fresh suit. And he didn't have one of the servants stand there. He himself stood there. I'll never forget it. I was a kid. That was 40 years ago. But the impression that made on me, the way in which a person can care to serve other people when he has all the means to just, you know, tell someone, gee, stand there and give out my suits. So, that may be the challenge of interpersonal sensitivity for some people. For other people, it could be a kind word, a kind gesture. It can be a matter of spending time with others who need it. For other people, it may be the quality of attachment to God in prayer. That's what they're capable of. That's what inspires them. So this area, of course, it all has a theme. Holiness, what is straight and good in God's eyes. But different people will fit into that theme in different ways. And this challenges people to grow individually. Individually, within the structure of the rules. If I can't violate the rules to do this. And building beyond the rules in a particular direction. So here again, you're going to have scenario type 2. You with me?
That's going beyond the rules. Now I want to speak to something which is more critical and more applicable to all of us, and that is living within the rules. Every living Jew is a failure. There is no Jew who is a total success. So says the verse in Ecclesiastes, there is no righteous person on the earth who will do good and not fail. Okay, there's a Ecclesiastes that says maybe it's not for all people, maybe there's 0.001% of the human population that escapes it, but that's please over everybody else. So, we're all failures. And I think the vast majority of people are multiple failures. It's not just that I have one area in which I'm failing, but considering my abilities and my resources, there are a lot of areas in which I could do better. Let's say that there are 14 areas in which I could do better. But I can't do better in all of them simultaneously. I could do better in any of them. Each one of them, singly, is under my control. I could do better. Maybe I could even handle 3 or 4 at a time. But that's it. I'm not going to do all 14. So priorities have to be set. Priorities have to be set. It means I say, I'm going to work on A, D, L, and Q, and the rest of them I'm not working on. Because I'm not capable of working on all of them at the same time. Life is piecemeal progress. And piecemeal sometimes means choosing the categories of the battle and living on other things. And this is going to be very individual. Because priorities are not set legally, they're set psychologically. That is to say, you don't look, let's say it's a choice between mitzvah A and mitzvah B, you don't just say, mitzvah A is legally more important than mitzvah B, so I have to choose A. Rather, what you ask is, which mitzvah, if I choose it, will lead to the greatest long-term mitzvah performance? And it might be that right now, choosing the legally less significant mitzvah will lead to the longer-term performance of the greater longer-term performance in the long run. I'll give you an example. This is a sort of drastic example. But this has a double, it's a kind of double whammy. At one time I was teaching in the girls' school in the Bay of Yerushalayim, and a young woman said to me, I'm making blessings over food before I eat. I don't believe in it. I don't believe in the whole system, to tell you the truth. But the other women here are doing it, and I'm sort of doing it because they're doing it. But I really feel like a hypocrite. What should I do? So I said to her, you can't build a foundation on hypocrisy or feeling like a hypocrite. So I tell you, stop making blessings until you understand, until you appreciate, until you be able to do it sincerely. Well, one of my colleagues there found out that I had said this, and boy, was my name mud. The holiness and the blessing, and how could you sacrifice, and it'll bring down blessings from heaven, and all that. So I began to wonder. I respect my colleagues, and he thought that I made a terrible mistake. So I began asking around. A friend of mine told me that he had gone to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that's the side of the Bracha, with exactly the same question a couple of years before. And what Shlomo Zalman said is, that's not a blessing. That's not a blessing. A blessing isn't reciting syllables that you don't believe in. A blessing is thanking God or praising God or petitioning God for something. And if she doesn't believe in God and she's saying the syllables because other people are saying them, it's not a blessing. That's the way to look at things. That's the way great people look at things. Small people look at the superficial aspects of it. But at any rate, here's the choice between doing or not doing, saying it in order to come to say it. And here the choice is, don't say it, don't participate, don't be part of it, because in the long run, that's not going to bring you to the end that's desired. Now, you could imagine a person, or this might not be imagined, it actually happens, a person who says, I can't imagine keeping Shabbos. It's just too big. My family, my work, my social setting, my habits, it's just, Shabbos is beyond me. But, I can say the Shema. So what do you say? Come on, Shabbos is one of the 10 pronouncements at Sinai. It carries capital punishment. And the Shema is very nice. You've got to do Shabbos. It's much more important. No, that's not what you say. What you say is, you're not ready for Shabbos. Okay. So do the Shema. Because the long-term effect will be a much greater effect than if you force the person at the beginning to do what legally is more successful. So even within the structure of mitzvahs, even within the structure of mitzvahs, there will be variations of development based on the psychology and the resources of the individual Jew who is trying to progress, and they will be within scenario two again. So really, scenario two has a considerable application in Jewish life. Just remember, the scenario two, you have rules which set the boundaries, and then you have a goal, which means that every decision has to be justified. You're never going to say, why did you do it? I did it because I felt like it. You with me so far? Now I want to confirm the rule by breaking it, or break the rule by confirming it, as my last point. Could there be a time when, within scenarios 1 and 2, within scenarios 1 and 2, spontaneity could be tolerated? Now that sounds like a contradiction. The way I define spontaneity, it contradicts 1 and 2. But let's imagine a person whose health depends upon having periods of time when he just drifts. He needs them. He needs time to operate randomly. Without that, he's going to be nervous and tense and upset and irritable and angry and aggressive and insensitive and nasty and all the other things you can pick up. And it's not nice to treat people that way. Indeed, it violates the Torah's mitzvahs to treat people that way. So for such a person, R&R, and for him, rest recreation might mean having an hour, 2 hours, where he just flows. And he can pick up a book if he wants to, or listen to music if he wants to, or go exercise if he wants to, or just flow. Because that's what the plan dictates that he needs. So here, within the whole structure, which is governed by rules and plans and values, you can have a pocket of spontaneous activity, because the rules dictate that this spontaneous activity is something that's important to you. That you can do. But now, if you are asked, so at 3 p.m, why did you read that book? The first answer will be, because I felt like it. But then if someone asks, why did you do what you felt like doing? The answer will not be, I told you already, because I felt like it. You know, that's all it is. That's the end of the story. I did what I felt like doing. No, the answer will be, because according to my plan of life, according to what I'm trying to accomplish, I need an hour a day where I do things that I feel like doing. And that's why at 3:15 I read the book that I felt like reading. Because my plan tells me that from 3 to 4 I should do things that I feel like doing. So it's not the same as the Sunday afternoon. It's the psychological effect of Sunday afternoon encased in scenario 2 type situation where you have the rules and you have the goal. And the hour of free activity is something that is productive vis-a-vis the values that you want to achieve. Okay? You with me? Is that ready? Let me just check that I've done everything.
That's it.
Thank you.